Okay.
Okay.
Okay. So today's point was the middle 20 years, which is taking the practice now outside of the Zendo, not leaving the Zendo, but in some way taking it out to other spheres of life. So there's, there's two things that come up for me. And the first is something that I already talked about last year, and we did a retreat about that, which is the householder life. So, there are a lot of great adventures, I think, of the whole Greyston time of building businesses and not-for-profits as practice and also as an adventure. And then the rest of us think, oh, well, we have children, we have aging parents, we have jobs. But actually, every single one of those areas is a place for practice. And this, I think, is the big deal in the West right now, that after 2,000 years of monastic practice, I think it's up to us to develop new means of waking up and helping others awaken in the life that we ourselves live, not as monks. So, for instance, those of you who know something about koans, all those koans, a monk said to, was it Chao Chu? I don't remember. Give me a teaching, and Chao Chu said, have you eaten your breakfast? And the monk said, yes. And Chao Chu said, wash your bowls. You see, those things, they've come to us as some kind of a, it's like a story, or for me, it's like when I read Shakespeare, so much of Shakespeare's become these aphorisms, sayings that are repeated so many times. If you read Hamlet, it's like half of it is going to be very familiar to you because people say those sayings all the time. So sometimes I catch myself reading Shakespeare and I say, ah, he's using a cliché. And then I think to myself, no, he's the original. He was the original. Afterwards it became a cliché. So in some way those are happened with those koans. They almost sometimes become clichés. But we forget that when they arose out of very close circumstances. So there were these monks studying together, and there was a teacher, and the teacher knew the students. He knew them, he saw them, they lived together, they ate together, they sat together. So when a monk said, give me a teaching, the answer was customized to that person in that situation. It wasn't just a cliche. It wasn't, here, I'll hit you. Well, why? Where did this hitting come, or where did this shouting come from? And our job in some way, and we have it, is to look at our own situations and say, what are our koans? So when Bernie said that the goal is how do you help people awaken everywhere in all areas of life, if you have, if you're living with someone and you go home, if you're a real bodhisattva, and we take those vows at the end that we're going to help all beings awaken, then it isn't like you did your job because you went to sit in the Zendo. You're now going home, and when your husband or wife says, what did you do today? What are you going to say? And what are you going to say that may help them awaken to the oneness of life? You see, right then, there's a koan. Right then, if you are ready to plunge into it. See, so those monks were ready to plunge. They had their teachers. They knew that their teacher is going to say something, maybe give a turning word. So they were ready to plunge. You know, what does he mean by that? What is that? What is that? So imagine that we, in our home, somebody says, you know, your child, you came back from, oh, you came back from here. And you go home, and somebody will ask you at work, at home, your friends, what did you do in Felsentor? Well, you know, they're high up, and, you know, they have nice rooms, and the food was pretty good. And there were these two weird teachers from the States, and, you know, and they told, so, you know, so you could do like that, or you could say, oh, so what answer am I going to give that is going to awaken someone, or do something, serve somebody in some way, going to take care of this whole thing? So that's when I started a compilation of our own householder koans. And the idea is, in your home, in your situation, what comes up for you that is like the old koans, which means, what is other for you? Where is there a situation that you stay away from? What are those things that, you know, where there's a call but you can't respond, or you don't know how to respond? That's your koan. And if you're ready to work with it in the way they worked with it in the old monasteries, I think it's going to be as effective in helping people awaken as those old koans. And there are some people here who've contributed to that collection of householder koans. But the point is that in every area of your life, there is the opportunity to do the kind of work Bernie talked about this morning, helping everyone awaken. And it's a brand new field. It's like a, what do we call it, a startup. It's a startup, really. It hasn't been done. What are the new ways? What are the new ways of doing this? What do we do with people who don't meditate? Do we say, ah, you're out of luck, you're never going to awaken? What do we do? We know, when he talked about Grayston, none of those people came to the Zendo. And there was really, you know, the way the Zendo was done then, there was no reason for them to come. You know, they were poor. You know, they looked at us and we were in silence like that. They didn't understand it, because what they needed was talking. They needed support. They needed to be there for each other. So they would go to these big churches, and they would be these great choirs, and they would sing songs, and they would help each other. And the preacher would preach and inspire them. And that really is how they took care of themselves. Am I convinced that sitting... They liked silence. Some of them really enjoyed 5-10 minutes of silence. But did they really want to be in silence for an hour and go to weekend retreats where it's all silent? And was that the thing that was going to take care of them? I'm not sure. So that, you go back to not knowing, you see. I think, oh, I know this is for everybody. But is it? Or is there some other way to show people that they're all one? And maybe it doesn't involve meditation. Maybe it involves something else. So it's a very new time for us, and I think it's a very exciting time, especially for what I call lay people or householders, people who are not monks. So that's one thing.
Can I add to that?
Sure, sure.
Now, as Eve was talking, I thought of a few things. One is, as you know, today was the funeral for Pierre Giga. And she was a sister, and the mother of her order, Katerina, St. Katerina Werk, for a long time. And she changed it. You all know her history. Some may not know if they're not from this area. But when she started, it was cloistered, and you know, they were in habit. And she changed everything. And she changed the whole group, St. Katharinenberg, to include first non-Catholics, other Christians, and then to include men, and then to... She broadened it quite drastically, and also did a lot of social action work. And she told us many times that that period in which she was changing everything, she almost died. Literally, it almost killed her. The stress of criticism, as you know, that's radical for the church, what she was doing. And then, of course, she falls in love with a priest, a Jesuit. He's still around. He was at the Nicholas Bronson. And they've been a couple for...
He said 41 years.
41 years. And for when we first met them, and I don't know how long they continued, they had gone to Paris in the beginning of their relationship. They had gone to Paris, and they actually discussed leaving. He's a Jesuit. She was St. Catherine. They decided not to leave their orders, but to be a couple. But in their language, not to be a genital couple. But they were deeply in love. And when we first met them, they were had been going every year back to Paris for their honeymoon, for their anniversary. And they both finished Zen studies. One in Japan, they both studied in Japan, one finished in Japan with the same teacher as Cornelius's teacher. So Nicholas is an uncle in that, Sambo Kyodan to Cornelius. Pia studied in that, but she finished with Eiken Roshi, who had also was part of the Sambo Kyodan. And so I'm also related to all of them. But when they first met, Nicholas first met me on the streets. I was doing a street retreat, and a Jesuit brother of his, American, said, my teacher, I was Bob Kennedy's teacher, he said, my teacher's doing a street retreat. And Nicholas said, and Bob said, I'm going to go join him. Nicholas said, can I come along? And so that's when I met Nicholas. He came to join that street retreat, the second or the first, I don't remember, that I did, and then invited me to do street retreats in Zurich, and to be part of a Christian Buddhist conference, and we did that. And then the two of them spoke to me and asked, could they also get Dharma transmission from me? Because they were teachers, they were established, they had groups, but they wanted to be connected to a lineage that was doing social action. And they loved a phrase that I'd used at that time, and they kept repeating. And Sunday, I did a keynote talk for their Zen in the West, and I think it was Anna who brought it up again. She said, can you explain the new wineskins?
Yeah.
What I had said, this is maybe 25 years ago now, that what's needed is new wineskins. And they said, yes, we need that, and in the church also, not just in the households, but the church needs new wineskins. And of course, they were creating. Yeah, they were creating new forms. So you could say forms, but a wineskin, it contains the wine, right? It holds the wine. It's something, so it's a form, it's a container. And that's what my second 20 years was all about. What are the new containers for the broader spectrum? But I when you talked about it, I just wanted to bring out that it was that it's not just the householders, it's the monastic forms that that need new wineskins. And
but Rocky, you know what I want to ask you?
Yeah. No.
What's a general couple?
A general couple is a couple that fucks around. Non-genital couple doesn't do that, but they kiss and they hug and they cuddle. They just don't fuck around. And that's what they decided to do. But it's still, as far as the church is concerned, that's not a good thing to do.
On that note. Okay, so the other thing. Oh, I knew I shouldn't have asked that question. So the other thing is, going back to the story of Greyston, so I have many wonderful memories of Greyston and how this group of Zen practice. Oh, I remember how I first came on the Zen community of New York, which was that a friend wanted to take me there because there was this teacher there from Brooklyn, and he thought I might like him. So we went, and we thought we were going to do Zazen. And it was a big, big, big mansion in a beautiful place, not like this, but green, and in a very wealthy neighborhood. And to our surprise, there was no Zazen that evening. Instead, they were having a community meeting in the dining room to talk about, to my great amazement, social action. And they were talking about, they had already...
What year is this?
This is 85. So the bakery had already begun, the business. And they were already serving food in the shelter. But now there was discussion about hiring more people in the bakery from the neighborhood. Not just Zen. Originally it was all Zen people. It was members of the community. And then it was that we're going to build apartments for homeless families. And then, you know, and there's going to be a child care center. And there's going to be this and that. And so here's this group of people, like you and me, there are fewer than here. There are fewer people than are in this room. And they weren't particularly talented or businessy, or they weren't bakers. I mean, they learned it all. They weren't naturally more talented than anybody else here. And they just said, okay, you know, this is, you know, so there was a visionary man who said, this is what I want us to do. Like he said, exactly, we opened this business, we have retreats, now we're going to do social action, we're going to develop this sphere and that sphere and that sphere. Going to develop new things, and we're going to do it all. And they said, oh, okay. And they were, nobody really believed it, but okay. And they did, you know, so that's the thing. And there's, and not everybody, because as Bernie said, many people, they didn't want to leave that beautiful place. So we left that place to go into a very poor area, full of drugs and prostitution and violence and killing and all kinds of things. And so many people wouldn't come because they didn't feel their cars would be safe there when they parked. You know, we had a Zendo on top of the bakery, but it wasn't like this. There were trucks going up and down.
And it wasn't like what we had, which was a mansion over looking the Hudson River. And half the membership left, quit. Yeah. They were afraid to make.
They were
that
afraid,
move.
And there was.
I can't blame them, but
right, and there was a paint factory with illegal immigrants across. It was a whole full of smells and very poisonous smells, and a meat factory on one side. Could you imagine with the carcasses hanging out? And next door was an all-night bar.
I loved it.
Loved it. It was great. You know, I mean, they went on all...
Not just the bar, believe me.
Yeah, so it's 4:30 in the morning. morning. We did weekend sashins there, so you could never sleep at night because they would just the music would be blasting through the walls exactly. And at about 4 in the morning, we always kind of met together. Why? Because that's when we woke up, and that's when they went to sleep. It was very simple. So there we were really religious. We had our robes on. They must have thought we were crazy, and we thought they were pretty crazy. So there we are in our black robes drinking coffee before the first thing, and they're coming out of the bar happy, you know, and there's a lot of women there, beautiful clothes hanging on to the, you know, to the...
We call it Johns.
To the Johns. And saying, come with me, I'll give you a good time, baby. And all these people are meeting. It's fantastic. And they're looking at us in our black. And they don't think there's anything weird. Maybe they think that they're, anyway, they drank a lot. So maybe they don't. And we look at them and they say, hi, how are you doing? And we said, we're fine, how are you doing? Okay. And that's fine. You know, so it all came together. It was a... So there's a lot of stories about Greyston, and also a lot of difficulties, everything that people come up with, you know, a lack of energy, a lack of money, things going wrong, you know, things you count on and then it doesn't happen, and cancellations and postponements and on, and it takes much longer than you think. And you're tired and you want to give up, but you don't want to give up. And Bernie does not give up. So that's what it was. But
I want to mention one thing.
Sure.
What I'd also like to mention, in those days when I was doing that, I had a, you know, I was in the early days of Zen, so I was friendly with all of the other Zen teachers. And most of the other Buddhist teachers, the Tibetan folks, the insight meditation, and they, what they would ask me when they knew about Greyston, and we started Greyston, and what they would all ask me is, am I teaching them to meditate?
Right.
So the model that was in their heads was the first 20-year model. Was I bringing that to this inner city? That's what they all wanted to know. How am I getting them to meditate? And so what the wineskins that they had were the wineskins from this first 20 years. And they thought that's what you got to bring. And what I told my teacher, I remember it was a little shocking to him. I told him that I am going to let go of everything I know, get into the not knowing, and wait for people from what we call the hood, the neighborhood, it's called the hood, wait for someone from the hood to arise as a leader, and I will learn from him what new wineskins we can make. He said, you can't do that. I've taught you all this stuff. You gotta, you know, teach. I said, no, I don't want to do it that way. So that whole process started again with the three tenets. I let go of everything I knew and waited for some people to pop up.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched what they did, and out of that start developing new ways of being. And we have the Greyston that you'll see, the Vegamings have seen, but you'll see it's quite unusual. But that was a major, major point in terms of especially our talking, that all of the teachers were expecting me to bring tools and ways out of that first 20 years into this very poor neighborhood where gangsters and in here. So in a sense, I just thought of it now. But in a sense, that's very common. That's called missionaries. That's what the missionaries did. They'd go into some area and bring their stuff. They didn't go into an area and see what's the deal here and bear witness to what's going on and develop new forms for the... That's exactly what it was.
Yeah.
And these were all people that didn't like the idea of missionaries.
Right.
But they fell into that right away. That's what you're supposed to do, man. We spent a lot of years learning our things. Now we got to teach the poor people and the heathens our ways. Anyway.
That's true.
That's first time I thought of that in this context. So, thank you.
You know what that reminds me of? I remember going up once with one of the women up front, and she was helped with the money, and she worked in the neighborhood. Her name was Hermina, and so we went out drinking one day.
She was our treasurer. Oh, our assistant treasurer,
right.
Bookkeeper.
And she says, "I don't understand what's with you Zennies." That's what they called us. You know, I mean, you're all kind of, you have these weird clothes, because we had, some of us have the clothes like Yozo's wearing. Only his is beautiful, it's clean, it's ironed. You don't even want to know what ours looked like. Especially Bernie's, with that yucky brown, with the threads all coming out and everything. You know, just why come you always wear dark clothes and you wear those dumb jackets and you're so serious. You're so serious, girlfriend. What's wrong with you, girlfriend? What's wrong? You know, it was like they were reacting to what is this separation? You still, even with everything Bernie says, we still cling to the old forms. So why would we wear a Japanese samurai jacket? Why in Yonkers, in this old, you know, why would we wear that? You know, because that's what we were used to doing, and everything was so serious, and this is our practice. Oh, forget about it. You know what I mean? It's like, she said, "Hey, girlfriend, why don't you just let loose, man?" That's what she used to say to me, let loose. And the other thing I remember, you know, so there was the front part, sales, administration, and in the back, people were baking. Now, in the back, if you were on the floor, the baking floor, you had the health...
This is a big bakery, wholesale, you know.
You had a health regulation, so everybody was in whites, and you had to cover your hair completely. If you had a beard or mustache, you had to cover it. So it was so interesting that the minute you walked on the floor, everybody started looking alike. Because they were all wearing the same thing and with the same kind of covering. So you could see who was white and who was black. You know, you could see that. But very often it wasn't so simple to see. And they were all listening to the same loud rap music on the intercom, and you know, they were all busy with the machines and the dishwashers and the ovens and the, you know, they were all, it was like all mixed. There wasn't that you know. And yes, there were some very serious Zen people there. There were PhDs from Harvard there. There were all kinds of people there, and they were all mixed up together, and it was so alive. It was so alive.
In one period we all had many different jobs at Grace, and there was a period where I'd come down at the end of the office hours day to help wash the pans. There was a lot of pans to wash.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember this guy,
the dishwasher,
who was hired to wash his pans. We had a few people like that, but this guy in particular had been a real tough guy. And one day he says to me, he says, "Bernie, I got to ask you something. I've changed a lot coming here," because he would never have thought months before he got the job that he would do that kind of work. I mean, he would sell drugs for a lot of money.
Yeah. He was a big dealer.
To do washing pans for a relatively small amount of money. He says, "I've done a lot of things. I've made a lot of changes. But I got to tell you, when somebody says something that angers me, I want to off them. What that means is I want to kill them. He says, how do I change their feeling from coming up? So those were the koans we dealt with. He was talking about different kind of koans. That's a koan. That's very, very direct.
Right.
And powerful.
Yeah.
What do we do when somebody gets us angry? We have very simpler things. We get angry and it's... but it's not that often that we get angry and what we want to do is kill the person that angered us. But for many people around the world, that's the normal thing. You anger me, I kill you. That's what we do.
But you know, some of us Zen people also wanted to kill each other.
For sure. So that's, those are gritty koans. You know, they're not maybe such a nice world, but they're an important world. They're an important world because those, in one degree or another, are very important koans, I think. I think.
Yeah.
And it was a very important. So I called that work practice because we worked together with the Zen students and the people off the streets. They all worked together. Had to deal with all the stuff that came up, and a lot of stuff came up, just like it comes up at Auschwitz. So it came up there, on the floors, and on the and why did it come up there, and why does it come up in Auschwitz? Because they're different cultures. The cultures are so different, and it's not easy to deal with different cultures. That was part of the beauty for me of the growth of Grace. And the other part, of course, was that we were providing housing and childcare and jobs, and people were going off of welfare, and all kinds of things were happening.
And AIDS care.
And when the AIDS epidemic started, we were right there to build housing for folks with AIDS, health center.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot more to say, but it's already 8:05, so I think it's better to get questions.
Yeah.
You know,
I've got a question. When you got rid of the old skins, the old wineskins...
Didn't get rid of them.
Sorry?
Didn't get rid of them. That's important. We created new ones.
Okay.
So the ones I had, I put aside in working there. I still would go home to our Zen community, which happened now to be in that same building. And we were using, in our agenda, we were using the old skins, but with the people in the neighborhood we weren't. Well,
okay.
This is a minor point, that we didn't get rid of them.
Actually, the circles are new wine skins in a Zendo environment, don't you think?
Oh, definitely. When I was taught, and I'm sure you were too, we aren't allowed to talk to each other about our practice.
Yeah. Okay, that was the question. What did you do instead? How did you... Because the wineskins is something you get hold of, and in the first 20 years, I suppose, it was important to have forms to be sure that you're doing right. And then you were sure and were able to get... to let them go to find new forms, but how? A little provocative question: What was the difference between a social worker and what you did?
Yeah. The difference was the three tenets.
Okay.
That was the difference between what we were doing and what a baker would be doing, or a therapist, or any social worker would be doing. The work we were doing, theoretically, was supposed to be based on the three tenets. Was everybody accomplished in doing that? No. Because, remember, the three tenets, you first got to put aside all of what you know and whatever. and really totally listen. It's hard to do. So most people doing that don't do such a great job. But that was a training, and that's where I would try to catch people if it looked like they weren't doing that. But I don't know any form that we gave up. You asked the same question. Ruth asked the same question. Didn't give up new forms. We brought in. Didn't give up old forms. We brought in new ones. I gave up. I disrobed. So that might be called giving up an old form. I decided at some point that the robes were not helping me do my work. They were hindering my doing my work, and I disrobed. But all those initial techniques. Now, some of the many things got modified. So when I was training in Los Angeles, the schedule was such that it destroyed families. I think, was it here? I mentioned that. So we started changing the schedules. What time do you sit in the morning and the evenings? And we start changing things so that families could still be families. That you didn't have to be in monastic to meet our schedule. So that's changing the schedule. And bringing the form of counsel into the Zendo was huge when we did it, because the rule when I trained, and I can't remember if I kept that same rule, I probably did when we started in New York, but certainly when I trained in LA, when you came to sit, you had Doksan with the teacher, interview with the teacher, but you were not allowed to talk with anybody else about what was going on with you in terms of the Zendo work, the practice. And the practice was called the sitting. When you said practice, you meant sitting. I shifted the word practice, and I still have to explain that, to mean trying to experience the oneness of life, or to experience non-duality. So it could be work, it could be anything. So I expanded the word practice. And we brought in counsel, which is a sharing. And for me, counsel and the three tenets are very intertwined. Listening from the heart is our first tenet of not knowing, deeply listening. Many people, when they listen to somebody, are judging it right away and saying it's this, it's that, it's what. So, and then speaking from the heart is bearing witness. It's bearing witness to what's happening and let that come up. Not planning. So, in fact, the originators or the big, not the original, Joan Halifax is the one who really developed the way of counsel in this country. She brought it from the North American Indians a long time ago, Lakota tribes. But there are other Quakers have a form of circle. There are many other kinds.
More questions.
What was the point of making a circle?
There were new wineskins that you brought into. Yeah.
Yeah.
I have one question of example. We are family. How we can practice? How we can take this work in our family, include it, we can join your work in such a country, in such a situation, we have to deal with our family. And also, I would like to offer my personal offering. How can I do that? Is there call for the person? I think for me and worse will be different. Mm-hmm. We have to meditate on different a point. How I can ask him, can I in this short time to feel, to practice myself in when I'm listening, when I'm feeling, when I'm hear your path? How can I connect it with my path in your work? Is the coin, is any coin for me to in this point or this moment I also can practice it?
So, you know, as a couple, I really recommend a lot for couples to do counsel with each other. It's a wonderful practice, and when you do it long enough, you really are able to say some very difficult things to each other. So when Bernie and I fight, which never happens,
never,
never happens. You know, when we argue, you know, one of us is going to say to the other, "Well, should we do counsel?" Exactly what we do here. So you can take that home with Urs and do that. And I don't know how old your child is. But already, even at that age, people are teaching their children to do counsel. So that once a week, you know, the whole family gets together and they learn how to do counsel. And it's a practice. And children have very short attention span. But they start learning and getting used to it. That once a week, this is what they do. And they begin to see themselves that, oh, this is a space where I can maybe say some things that I don't feel safe saying in other places. But I think especially for a couple, it's a fantastic practice. In terms of how you can connect to our work, so I think Bernie was going to talk about the Zen Peacemaker Order Sunday morning. And there may be some answer to your question then. But I would say more directly, you know, you have to do whatever, you know, work you're going to do. You're going to make your offering. You know, so Bernie makes his offering, I make my offering. It's very different. We have very different paths, he and I. We aren't always together or anything. And you're going to make your offering, you're going to make your offering, you know, and that's going to be your work. I'm not, you know, where it may come together is in these big containers, these new wineskins. So something like a Zen Peacemaker Order is a new container, a new wineskin to bring together and support people who want to do this kind of work based on the three tenets. And Pia Giger actually was absolutely vociferous, meaning very eloquent and insistent about the need for healthy structures and good structures that help people do their work. She always talked about it. And the Zen Peacemakers, I hope, the Zen Peacemaker Order is going to be such a structure that will bring people together who want to do work like that. And they'll do different work in different countries, in different continents. But there will be some things that they have in common and support them.
We have time.
We have lots of time. Okay? What else? Katharina.
This morning you told of your experience and how it started, the change from the first 20 years to the second. And the Sibing Eve mentioned that there were difficulties. And my question was, what made you not to give up? One question. Was it really only this one experience? I can't believe that. And the other thing is, I know for myself things arise and I think, wow, that's it. And 2 days later I have a lot of doubts and I let fall it down. And I go the old ways. And for me it's a question of trust. Can I really trust in what arises? And is it only fear to go new ways? But one of the things is that I think, oh, it's only defeated by old patterns, it's not really a new thing, and don't trust in it, do your things you have done all your lifetime. So, these two.
The first one's easy to answer, the second one was...
What happens when you have your self-doubt and you want to
do it? So my experience is that always there is self-doubt. And but I like to look at it in a positive way, that's what drives you to resolve that doubt. Some people say, the first time I read this was Yamada Roshi, he said that he defined a daik kensho, a great enlightenment experience, as being one in which there is no more doubt. And that is extremely, extremely rare. Until then, no matter what's happening, whether you have enlightenment experiences or don't, you're going to have doubt. Now, his teacher talked about doubt as one of the three elements that's needed for practice. And doubt is one. Determination is another. That I have this doubt, but I'm determined to resolve the doubt. And a third is that you do it. You don't give up. Okay. And then you ask, how do you not give up? That's easy to answer in a way, because I don't think you can teach somebody not to give up. Some people don't give up. Some people give up. Some people give up for a while and start again. I don't know. In my life, I've never found it interesting to give up. I get interested when things aren't working and things are falling apart. That's exciting for me, and I want to see how to make it work. But that's just a weird characteristic I have. I don't know. I think I was born with that, you know. I was just this little baby, and I couldn't reach my mother's breast. And I wouldn't give up, man. I wanted that breast. So I could, so it started then. and it continues now, you know. Now I don't know what to do about the Middle East, but I'm not going to give up. I'm going to, you know. And the bakery and Grayson almost collapsed a number of times. And I didn't give up. I just kept going. And I think that's one of the characteristics of an entrepreneur. They don't give up. And they don't look at failure as a problem.
Can I say something, Brian?
Yeah.
I think that if we're lucky... You said Bernie had an experience that took him into that. So I didn't have that experience. But I think what happened to me may be more common to most people than what happened to him. And that is that as time passes, you know, you really get finally that it's not about you. You know, you just kind of get it. And it's a slow process. And it doesn't mean that you don't take care of yourself. You know, in the Grayston years, one of my big koans that I used to bring was, what about me? Yeah, we're taking care of them, we're taking care of them, we're taking care of them, we're taking care of them. What about me? It was a big, it was a very important koan. So you don't, when, you know, you're taking, it's like everyone is being taken care of. You know, so then people get into their dramas and, oh, but it's not good enough and I failed again. I thought I was doing it again. I failed. Look what, you know, I knew I shouldn't do it. It's catastrophe is around the corner, blah, blah, blah. And it's all very entertaining and upsetting and all that. But in the end, it's like, oh, you know what, I'm sorry if I've told this story, but it's stayed with me for so many years, this story. I always tell Bernie what was the shortest Dharma talk he ever gave. And that was when we first got into this, we got a building for to develop as apartments for homeless families. And we had no money, we went into debt, it was, you know, postponed, it was just a mess. So we got this old, old building and the roof was leaking and it had been abandoned and locked up. And a few people, you know, I wasn't one of them, but Bernie, they opened it up. We owned it, we were able to open it up. So that night he sat down and he gave a Dharma talk. And he said, look folks, today we went into, the address was 68 Warburton Avenue. And we went into the entrance and it's all dark because there's no electricity. The floor is terracotta floor, very old, full of water. There's a staircase going up and at the bottom of the staircase is a dead dog. I guess people must have, somebody locked the dog there and left it. So there's the carcass of, you know, this is a long time it's been left like this. So he said, you know what we're going to do? We're going to take out the, you know, and people did. They took out the dead dog and buried it with a Buddhist ceremony. And we're going to clean up the floors and we're going to do, we're going to renovate the whole building and we're going to change the roof so there's no more holes and no more rain coming in. Fully renovate the buildings. There'll be 18 beautiful apartments. There'll be a big day child care center. It's going to be the beginning of everything. And then we're going to build more apartments. And we're going to do more of this. And we're going to do more of that. Now, at that moment, we were broke. But it didn't matter. You know, we had no money. We're going to do all this. And then you know what's going to happen after years. You know, some of you are going to leave. This is going to happen. You know, there'll be, you know, there'll be a big financial recession. So after about 50 or 100 years, we'll be dead, and the place will be abandoned, and it'll be empty again, and it'll be fall into disrepair, and there'll be leaks coming from the roof, and finally families will just leave the building, and somebody will lock a dog, and leave a dog, abandon a dog inside. And it's going to remain like this for another 50 years. And then maybe another person one day is going to open, buy the building, open the door, see the dead dog. And that was it. And that's our work. And it was, you know, it's always stayed with me because he wasn't saying, please don't have big expectations like you're going to solve the problems of the world. You know, really, let's get real here. There's a flow here. It's not my flow, and it's, I don't think it's Bernie's flow. It's, you know, it's life. Life is flowing. You know, it's just a big fall, and it's flowing. And, you know, we make such a big deal about ourselves. Oh, my God, can I do this? Can I write this? Can I do this? Am I enlightened enough? And this and this. And we cry, and we laugh, and that's okay. That's wonderful. But, you know, at some point, there's a big, it's not about that. And when we start getting it more and more, that's not about that. It's just about the water just flowing, man, and just go with it. You know, find something where you fit in and then just go with it. And don't worry. Just don't worry.
That sounds like good advice. I think so. Thank you.
Is that it?
Oh, it's good.
Okay, so we have time for another question and then maybe go to into silence. Huh? One last, yes.
I have a question about Brian Wilkes. When you
cultivate the quality of benevolence, is it the same as cultivating compassion? Maybe it's only a concept.
Okay, so the way I define what I mean by bearing witness, it has many words in English, and when you translate it, we all know that the translation in German is not such a good translation. What I meant when I came up with bearing witness in English as the second tenet, I meant shikantaza. So what is shikantaza? Shikantaza is a Japanese word. Shikan means just. Za means sitting, and ta means is a grammatical term that makes whatever else is in that word emphatic, strong. And to do shikantaza, that's to be in a state of non-duality. It's got nothing to do with compassion or any other label, because then it's, any label takes you out of non-duality. So it's just being in that state where there is no subject, no object, the state of non-duality. So I was looking for, how do you translate shikantaza? You can't translate it as just sitting. It doesn't work. You can translate it, but it's clumsy, as just sitting. That's what shikantaza is. And in that state, there's no duality in that. So that's what I was meaning by the word bearing witness. So maybe that gives you a better sense of bearing witness. So when we say in shikantaza, to just sit and whatever arises, arises, let it be, become it, let it flow away, you know. So in the practice of bearing witness of the three tenets, become the situation. Koan study, you guys do koans with Frank?
Yes.
You do koans?
Yes.
Yeah. So koan study is the study of bearing witness. You have to become the koan. And as long as you're not the koan itself, and you come to the teacher with a description of your what you've realized, that's no good. You got to present yourself as, in the best of all worlds, what koan study is about is presenting yourself as the koan. And if it's many people, you're presenting yourself as many people. You're presenting yourself as the non-dual situation that's described in that koan. So in life, the same thing. To bear witness to life is to bear witness to all of the elements without any dualistic thinking. And that's why it's not simple, and why we create practices to help you learn that learn how to do that. And just the same reason why they created a koan system, to learn to do it through that. But I want to add one little thing, because before koan system is not so old. It only goes back a certain ways. And before that, it was what Eve was describing, that you're in the monastery. And sometimes the monastery was just a little individual huts on a mountain. A mountain might have had 100 monks, and they were living there separate, and they would gather here to teach and talk. But their practice came out of the stuff that happened in their lives on that mountain. And as he said, the teacher knew each of them. I mean, they were living together. And things would happen. They would stub their toe on a rock. And the teacher would work with what was going on. Then there grew a period where people weren't living together like that. And somebody, whose name happened to be a Hakuin, develops a system, a koan system, to using a lot of those same incidents as things for the new people that are going to study to train with. So now they're working on not things that happened in their life, but things that came out of the stories of other people's lives. And some people got very upset that that was going to kill the practice of Zen koans, because it was working with dead stuff. It wasn't working with stuff out of the life. And in fact, in Japan, in the Rinzai tradition, it got mainly very, very dead, because in order to be in charge of your temple, you had to pass a certain amount of koans, and so the teacher would start selling the koans, the answers. And for the majority of folks that do koan study there, it's just a matter of how much dollars you're paying so that you can be in charge of the temple. It's got nothing to do with the experience of the identity of life. But of course there are also wonderful Rinzai teachers. But that's why Yasutani got upset. One of the reasons he got upset with the standard stuff. So in a way, what we're doing is bringing, and what Eve is doing in her group, is bringing, not using the koans that developed from old histories, which you said is the old monastic thing, their histories. She's using koans that developed from the students' lives. And that's what you're asking, what do I do? You work on things that's in your life. And anything that's in your life, same with those guys back in China 1,000 years ago, man. They walk out of their hut and they see this beautiful woman, nude, taking a bath, and they get all excited and they go to the teacher, what do I do? And he make them work on it as a koan. So that's what you guys got to do.
He would make them work on it as a koan?
Yeah. Oh boy. Imagine if Tootsie was available to all these Zen teachers. They'd go crazy. Be good for them.
And you call that the direct approach?
Dichi Suzuki was one of those who felt that the koan system was destroying Zen, because it made it more of a dead practice instead of out of people's lives. And those things got written down. It all got very formal and away from life. That was at least his feeling. He was very critical of koan study. I love koan study, and I see those problems. So if you're going to use koan study, there's a way of making it alive, bringing that into the person's life. If you can make it live, then I think it's wonderful, which means no fixed answer, because it's got to be a function of the person's life.
Can you please give us an example how we can, in the daily life, use koan as a daily life practice?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a simple koan. How do you stop the fighting across the river? And you could do that in formal koan study. But you could also say, how do I stop the fighting in Gaza? It's the same koan.
Or how do I stop the fighting in my own home?
And that's the same koan. How do I stop the fighting with myself? Same koan.
I have been in a koan also a session for some time. And there was a simple koan, just like who is in.
Who is?
In. Who is in me. Or in what is happening.
Yeah.
And I will practice face by face, each one 5 minutes.
Uh-huh.
So for that, I find out, when I face each one person, maybe here I have 30 person, when I face each one, I got different energetic, also different faces. Through their face, for me, I have different answer in the same.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. For me, they were so directly straight to ask me, where is in me? I have been carrying on. and also for me to bring it out as a, like the river, to bring it out to look at it and to watch of it. And for me to look at the person eyes to eyes, I get deeply washed and refreshing, and I feel the transformation straight away. Mm-hmm. And there was a very simple, just time. Face each other, and this time for others to give it to me, I give it to them. That was such a powerful. And once I was, they just both two person, just 5 minutes, and others 5 minutes. And in the end, I come out with such grateful.
So why do you ask the question? You have the answer.
Yes, but I feel like there is, dojo is the place to bring such differences, experience together. And for me right now, I'm also looking for the place. Like, how can I bring my richness? How can I bring the such things that carry on in me? How, where I can go and to say, I would wish to keep this as a present out.
Okay. My immediate feeling as you talk is you need to find the teacher, and you may have a teacher to work with.
Yes.
Because it can't be all your own things. You'll drive yourself crazy, or you'll make yourself too. But that's important. That's what I, when I said in my early years, and I decided to quit then or whatever. But you're asking questions that you should be working with, I think, with somebody. If you're only working with yourself, you're bound to get yourself into a problem. That's my opinion. You don't have to listen to my opinion, but my opinion is that that is critical, and that's not enough. So hopefully, but again, it's my opinion, for many people, that's the kind of practice that is only one. And that's enough to do that. In my opinion, there's more to life than dealing with just your own stuff. And that hopefully the teacher, I would hope that the person you find to work with will also, besides work with your own stuff, help you to move out of your own stuff. But I would say 80% of practitioners work with their own stuff all the time. So it's okay, but it's not my way. And so if you were asking me, if I was your teacher,
yes,
man, I would give you a kick out of, to kick you out of yourself and into a bigger sphere. That's what I would do. And you might not like that kick, but that's what I would do. But that's me, so don't get close to me.
I'm looking for the kick. And also I'm looking to the person if they can also take the kick.
Yeah.
So I think the teaching and listening, the student and the teacher, they are coming to the one point of, in Chinese we say, when we are still are not awake, we bound for the teacher. When we are awake, we are bound for the student. That means we learning for the student. In the awakening part, we say, when I am not understood, I asking for the answer. When I understood, I asking answer to come to me. So that means I'm learning for the student where it come from. So I feel like this is like a meeting. The teacher and the student are meeting each other, and where is the point? It's you and me, we are same. And I think that feeling, for me right now, I feel like I need somebody just to sit in front of me. I just want to talk. But for now, until now, I feel like I'm more listening than talk. But I also need to listen from what I want to say from this person as empty, as unknown. What is inside I want to say? I would like to understand. I would like to have this chance. And what I'm really, sometimes I feel like I want to stand up and jump. I want to, my body has some place I also want to talk. It's not only talking, but also action, but also energetic emotion. And all of this part, of these thousand hands, where to put. So I feel right now I'm like a cloud full of water. I want to find a place to rain. And where is the place beside me, receive me? I'm hurry on to find a toilet to relieve my stuff. And for now, I also have to practice myself. Where is my patience? How I can relieve just by listening to somebody's path. I also want to tell my path. I also want to give my treasure. Oh, where is the empty space? Where is now and here? Where, how I can bring meaning for my fortune to the future to say, this is it. I want to use that. I want to meet you. Can I say something to you? I'm afraid to ask.
Thank you.
Yeah. And I think this is also a place for me in this such feeling of myself. I also feel all of ourself in one. And I would like to, because I'm sorry, I come from East. So all of what you have passed, also where I come from. So I know from the beginning, I want to run away from that. So I come to here to learn something, and I also would like to share what I have learned from the West. I would like to also share what I have learned from the East. And the important is, where is the meeting? Where is now and here? How I can bring me to the next step? Hurry. Also of life, what I want to experience before my last breath. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
What time is it?
1:45. Let's, can we turn off the lights and sit till 9 o'clock?
I have no idea.